I say Emmanuel, and stuff comes out of Emmanuel that Pat doesn't know. I know she doesn't know, because I sort of know where she grew up and how she grew up, and she doesn't know that stuff. But this stuff comes through. Now, I have no idea, as I wrote in the preface, whether this is Pat's multifrenia, you know, and this is another part of her being talking, because God, Guru, and Self are one and the same thing. So it may well be this is just the way another part of her schizoid personality manifests, and I'm getting a vertical schizophrenia here. I'm getting two planes instead of a horizontal schizophrenia. So I decided I didn't care whether it was her mind or whether it was Emmanuel out there in La La Land, because my job was whether whatever it was used to me. My job was to become free, to be able to be free compassion and free awareness. And so I stopped asking. I stopped becoming the good housekeeping seal of approval. I decided to let it all in. See, I was trained as a social scientist in a time when science was not on the defensive yet. It was still arrogantly thinking it had reality down. And I was trained that way. And so it's very hard for me to let in all this Meshuggah stuff of other planes. But I realize that I can afford to let it in because there is still something in me that intuitively breathes towards truth, goes towards truth, and that's the best I can do. So I stopped asking that kind of a question. Am I dealing with your question or not?
You very definitely dealt with a significant part of it, but if I may try...
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Not just the person on the plane of your relationship between your guru and yourself, but powers that some might associate with the word God or the saints. Well, I don't know whether you're the saints or what have you, but the powers beyond what we can see of as human power, okay, that have control over and direct, can have some degree, varying degrees of control over human experience. Have you personally felt that in your life?
I personally felt that there are more powerful forces defining realities than the ones we think we are dealing with? And the answer is yes. By adopting the standard stance of listening, of being a listener, to hearing my way into the way my life manifests, rather than what I think I'm doing. I get into a lot of trouble because I take what you're saying right out to the edge and say, your idea that you have free will is an illusion. There is a deeper and more wise set of forms that you're responding to. And until you extricate yourself from your identity with your own thought, and even that, and the learning how to do that is part of it, that's all conditioned. It's all determined along the way. I mean, it's not fatalism. It's because it's living determinism, but it's determined. But then you ultimately arrive at what freedom is, which means awareness not trapped in aversion or attraction. And that wisdom, that being is free to be what is, and out of that being what is comes the act. Okay? Yeah. Yes? You?
When is the Christ being made?
What does the Christ being mean to me? Well, I think what we've been talking about all evening is Christ consciousness. I think there's only one of that thing. And you can label it depends on which way you went up the mountain, but I think Christ consciousness is what it's about. There is the Jesus story and Christ consciousness, all right? And the story is an incredible story for awakening certain qualities of compassion, and it is a path through going through relationship into the deep. So you meet Jesus, you love Jesus, you follow Jesus, and through Jesus you meet the Christ. And then you meet it, and then finally you realize you are the Christ. I and my Father are one, as I am, so you are. That should get me shot. I'm about to start. I'll give you 1 second. I'm gearing up. See, I'm getting old. You know, I'm tired of traveling so much. So, but all these people say, why don't you come back to Palm Springs or Indianapolis or somewhere? So I thought, I'll use the media. But television's expensive and neurotic and it's all power. It's really not fun. So I decided to use radio. Then I decided to use AM radio, because that's like, I move right into the belly of the beast, you know, with just rushing me. So I'm going to start next September. I'm doing my pilots this December, and I'm hoping to start next September a 2-hour weekly AM radio talk show, call-in. And it's really just this, you know, going on every week. It's a place to hang out, a place for us to hang out. I mean, it's like creating a space using that kind of rail where we don't have to get our bodies all here in Sacramento. So, but I know that doing that, I will immediately provoke people who will not ask the question with the consciousness you're asking it from. It won't be, what do you feel about Christ? It'll be, what do you, you know, don't you realize? Yes. Prozac. I'm going to talk about Prozac and Zoloft and all those wonderful, tasty things like Soma in Brave New World. I'm bad tonight. Well, what I experience is that life within this cultural framework does not fully bring individuals into a sense of fulfillment, at homeness, at peace, equanimity, joy. And the way they respond to not getting there is a variety of ways. Some people say, screw it, they vote to go out of it. They use drugs to escape, and that's crack, and that's all kinds of things. That you have whole classes of society that are getting incredible oppression and unfairness in terms of our just and fair democracy. You have an underclass we do not yet understand how to communicate with, let alone honor and respect and draw. And many of those people say, screw it. And they use drugs to escape. A lot of middle class people who made it then start to feel the pain of having won, and they still don't feel good. And then they get into more is better, and that's more like cocaine rather than crack. It's a different subculture and a different way of using stuff. Now, there are other people who feel depression. And some of the depression, see, because of the intimacy of the mind and the body, since we know it's one thing, we really can't start out by saying with any clarity, is the dominant determining factor environmental corruption? Is it the air? Is it the water? Is it the cancerous things in food we eat? Is it stuff that suddenly, is it a virus? What is it that brings on, say, Epstein-Barr, or brings on whatever that other thing is. What do you call it? Chronic fatigue syndrome, yeah. CFS. In our society, we tend to treat symptoms, not causes. And Prozac is clearly a symptom reducer. For people that don't have much energy, that are depressed, for many of them, their life is really a drag, and Prozac gives them a new kind of sense of coming back into some kind of energy they can work with and they feel good about. I share a little concern with others that the cost isn't free in this. That to cut off the bottom end, you may also be screwing around with the top end too. That in terms of creativity or in terms of the emotional passions of the whole cycle, there may be a cost to becoming more equanimous that way. I don't know. I'm just saying what I'm sharing with you. The data aren't in, because there are many people that swear by Prozac and Zoloft and say it's affected my life. There are other people who started and they say, there's something about this, I don't want to go this trip. And they push it away or something like that. So let's just keep listening. And I'd say for each human being, you have to make your own decision. And nobody else should be making it for you. You should make it. If you say it doesn't feel good, screw what the doctor says. You do what you feel. Doctors are caught in dealing. You are a package of symptoms to which they are trying, it's a puzzle to which they're trying to figure it out, because their identity is in the success of getting, solving that puzzle. And what's extraordinary for me in working with the dying is the way in which the medical community sees death as an enemy and sees death as a failure. And yet everybody goes through it. So from the doctor's point of view, what a world. I mean, no wonder your doctors drink. It's a hard world. Sir?
I actually have two questions. First question is, on your talk show, will people be able to use a phone to call in? The second question is... But seriously, how do dreams fit into your practice?
In answer to the first question, the show may exist on more than one level. I met a woman not too long ago who said to me, you know, you and I sleep together every night. Okay, why not? And that too. Dreams. I'm primarily using dreams in a metaphorical way in terms of my own. I'm not really interested in interpreting dreams, because it just seems like more stuff to me, and I've already got so much stuff. You know, this drama is enough without creating more drama. I mean, there are people say, do you realize the planet you're something is in something to? Oh my God, no, you know. But I really got so much going already, just with, you know, flowers and flat tires and, you know, stuff like that. So I'm trying not to be cute. What dreams do show you is the solidity of other realities. So in that sense, they are very useful. And since that is true, and different people move up the ladder of consciousness in different ways, one of the ways of moving up the ladder is through working with dreams. And so people who really understand dreams and can do it can show you the interaction between planes of consciousness in the way your soul is manifesting and working on itself through these many planes. And the understanding of one plane helps to free you from the identity with the other plane exclusively. Okay. Yes, ma'am. She said that her mother died this past year, and she doesn't know how to feel about what's happened to her mother, because her mother died in not a very awakened or conscious way. And well, let's just put it that your reactions are your reactions. Okay, that's what you've got to work with, is your mind, because you don't know. You know, and she apparently isn't telling you, so you don't know. So, But what you can find is that the more you can connect with the deeper parts of your own being, the more you can align yourself with the deeper parts of her being. I'll tell you just this funny little interesting story. My mother was a very good Jewish middle-class, well-meaning, hard-driving mother. She really did it, you know. She took me analysis and drugs and everything to finish with my love affair. So when she died, I remembered it that way, with love and a relational thing as my mother. And I grieved. And then I met my guru, and the second day I was with him, he said to me, through a translator, he said, "Your mother is a great being." And I said to him, I thought there was something lost in the translation, I said, "She was a great being." You know, I allowed that she was a great being if he said so, but you know. And he said, "Nay, she is a great being." And a very interesting thing happened to me at that moment. Probably in our whole life together, maybe that I could count on almost my fingers, with the number of times she and I met behind our roles of mother and child or of fellow whatever we were in the game. There was a moment when I was coming back from the dentist in the car with her in the rain, and we were seeing who could hold a note the longest. I was about 9 or something like that. And we pulled up to a stoplight, and suddenly we both became aware that there was a man in the next car looking at us as if we were totally insane. I mean, we were both screaming at the top of our lungs. And what that did was cast us into a relationship that was different than whatever else. Those few ones and the ones that I had with her just before she died became real, and all the rest of it became the storyline. Do you hear that reversal, that figure ground reversal? And after that, the grieving was over. Yeah. So what you're still reacting to is her story. And as you are less in the story yourself, you will meet her, and then you will recognize more who you both are and how it had to be the way it was. Yes. Earth changes the turn of the century. I'm trying to put those two things together for you. I mean, so because you're asking them as if they're one thing, you know. You're saying, what major changes might we expect in the millennium, in the turn of the century? And by earth changes, you don't just mean soil and trees. You're talking about all of it, right? Is that what I'm hearing? I want to answer the right question you're asking. Because I give an environmental rap, but that isn't what you're asking. It's a good rap, too. Well, the truest answer is I don't know. But I would say that what I've been talking about this evening is that there is some process of consciousness shifting that is occurring that is making the way we see reality different. And it's accelerating at this point, and it seems to be engaging more and more people. And that implies that the change that we might be talking about is a change in collective consciousness that would change the nature of the way we walk on the earth and whose moccasins we walk in and all that stuff, all right? So that may be dealing with your question in one way. On the astral thing as to whether some great dramatic thing is going to change, to me, nothing's more dramatic than consciousness, so I can't even hear any other level. I mean, to me, that's the interesting level. I would say that almost every social institution is modified by that consciousness shift. And therefore, a lot of them change their form or their meaning or their function. It's interesting, like I have a friend who works in the White House, and I said, not the Clintons, somebody else, and I said, is there anybody there that is reflective? Is there anybody there that doesn't have line power, but is like the king's elders or, you know, wise people that are just there to hold the vision, to, you know, not for any party thing, just to hold the greater vision? And this guy said, no. Now, that question, he understood the question, and I understood the question. That question will be a more real question as time goes on, to the point of view where politics will not be functional without that kind of reflection. See, and that moves you from politics to statesperson, or whatever you want to call the next level of that sort of thing. Okay, that's the kind of thing. So it's a big stuff, it's not little, and it impacts all of the way we live. I mean, you can say to somebody, for the good of the sustainability of this precious earth, you should practice voluntary simplicity. And people will do it out of, I ought to and I should. As their consciousness evolves, they'll do it because they'd be a damn fool not to. It's a whole different level. I mean, how could I not do it? It's like the commandments, thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. At one level, okay, I won't because you're afraid of hell and damnation. A moment later, when your consciousness is, you see the interweaving of everything, the way the karma works, and you'd be a fool to do it. Why would you soil your own nest? What a stupid thing to do. Sir. I would say that the reactions to death are a very vital question in this culture. If you look at the, for example, the newspapers about Dr. Kevorkian, about abortion, about capital punishment, about inner city violence and murders each day, I would say there is little short of an obsession about death. And so I would say, if that colors our culture so much, how do you address that issue if you would like to not be just part of a cultural paranoia or fear? So you look at it and you say, well, there are three questions that all my work in dying over 30 years has brought to me that people seem to be concerned of. Is there anything after? What's the moment like? And how do I prepare? Now, like Castaneda says, keep death over your left shoulder. It's not that you have to become obsessed with death, not at all. It's your obsession with the denial of death you're getting over. It's not the obsession with death. The game isn't to sit around saying, dying, 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 I'm ready to die, am I ready? Because you realize as you go deeper into your own practice that the best preparation for death is to live life, live this moment fully and consciously and compassionately. But to live this moment fully includes everything. It's nothing. If you push away something, you're not living this moment fully. And living this moment fully includes your death, just like it includes your birth. Well, because all we're doing really is asking whether or not, the only real question you can ask is there a bigger context in which we live? Is there another context besides the one that our rational mind knows? And the answer is you don't know. But how do you deal with not knowing? Do you deal with not knowing saying, well, I'll assume there isn't and live as if there isn't? I would say that is as much a trap of the mind as living with, there's going to be a heaven and hell. So I would say, all you have is the mystery of the unknown, but I, in the presence of the unknown, I allow for the possibility that there is something that I don't understand. That's all. That's all I'm doing about that. And that's coloring everything after that. It's coloring everything. I mean, it's hard if you haven't... Well, I've lived in India where the death is a very much part of life. And it doesn't seem to bring these people down. It seems to enrich their lives. That's what I experience, much more than I see in this culture. So, but I always come back to it's a mystery and I don't know. And I think that's a comfortable one that you can sell right across the board. Okay? Yes. It's a good investment. It was 333 then. It's now 1313 or something, some absurd thing like that. Yes. Oh, I'm trying to give everybody a chance. You didn't. Go ahead. Obviously, it isn't a reasonable matter, is it?
No. So what I'm doing is I must be doing something wrong.
No. What's wrong is you're thinking that. What you're doing is you're doing everything you can to heal. The art form is to do it all because that's the appropriate thing to protect this human precious birth, but not be attached to the outcome. I know it's tricky, but that's the attachment to the outcome is coming from your identification with your body. And so ultimately you keep extricating yourself until you're talking about taking care of your body, not much different than I talk about taking care of my old 23-year-old MG. All of it. All of it is true, and I feel my heart feels for you. But at the same moment, if you get caught in being that person, the rest of it becomes hell. I mean, at least just keep it as a thing you're dealing with. You're working to get better as well as you can. You're dealing with a social, all the way society does it. You're dealing with all of the stuff of loss of role, of shift of role, and all that. The question is how much your consciousness gets caught in that. And whether you can fulfill being somebody with muscular dystrophy and be an impeccable muscular dystrophy healer person without getting caught in any of it. I mean, it's like being a vegetarian without being a vegetarian. I eat vegetarian food. But you know, it's like people that drive cars. They drive cars, but they're hurtling through space, and they're hardly ever, if you say to somebody, "Who are you?" they say, "I'm a driver." Usually tuning the radio or planning where they're going to go or where they've been or something, or looking for police or some other nefarious activity. So the art, it's the same thing no matter what the predicament. It's how do you fully involve yourself in doing what you can to heal, but constantly bring your awareness back into a resting space. It's the statement out of the Tao, one does nothing and nothing is left undone. Those are two planes of consciousness. I invite you to use the muscular dystrophy as your spiritual practice to extricate yourself so you are a being and there is muscular dystrophy. And at the level of muscular dystrophy, you're doing what you can to heal it. And at the level of being, you're just sitting and being with it.
It's multiple sclerosis.
I'm sorry.
That's
my ignorance. I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. The same applies for multiple sclerosis, okay? I didn't mean to trivialize it at all because they're very different. Sir. With the what?
Paradigm.
Paradigm? What is it? I think I'm on some kind of an advisory thing in that. Yeah. I don't really know. I don't think I've ever been to anything. I think they send me stuff, but you know, it feels like something that's good. Yeah. Yeah. That's all I know. Okay? Yeah. He was asking about paradigm. Excuse me, I didn't repeat that question. Sir?
For a moment about the pervasive nature of computers and technology and that sort of thing, and how to quickly resonate on how to make a distinction between what might be a life-affirming use of these wondrous technologies and what is less than that.
He's asking about technology, like computers and television and all those things. And how do you differentiate between what's life-affirming and what could be deleterious to the human spirit? Once you start to awaken, and that's what you want to do, everything becomes useful to awaken. All right? The worst of it. The worst of it. And until you do, and as long as you want something other than that, you'll get it, you know, and you might go into stupor's dependency on blup for a while. But if you realize the soul doesn't live in time the same way, you relax, you know. I mean, I've watched myself be so incredibly neurotic. I just took this contract to do this book, and so I had 2 years to do it. And I spent about 11 months of it just dealing with my own neurosis. And part of it was that I had bought a new laptop and I had to learn a new word processing thing and trying to write the book with time and all of the emotional stuff that all involved of just being ready to create in the damn button doesn't something I push wrong, and you know, getting through all that and calling the people and consulting and having to think like computers think. I mean, I just don't live in that thought domain. I can do it if I have to, and I have to, so I do it. But it's not the kind of slippery world that I live in of consciousness. And so I just feel it as an interesting discipline to learn to live on more than one consciousness without getting caught in the exclusivity of any of it. I don't see why I can't be a really good computer player, just like I'm practicing to be a golfer. I don't have to buy all the mythology connected with it. I mean, I do not believe we are just information. I think that's part of the less interesting parts of what we are. I think we have information which we now have a glut of. I just start on the internet and I get overwhelmed. But then you put bits of information together and you have knowledge. That's really fascinating. That's what all our universities do. But then there's still wisdom. And wisdom is when you let go of knowledge in order to experience the totality out of which comes wisdom. And that's a whole other level of the ballgame. So I don't see any stage as inherently bad or good. You know, you just use them to the extent that your evolution or readiness prepares you to use them. Yes, I think we have to stop in a moment. Yes. When I talk about prayer, please. Prayer is from the way I understand prayer, is a form of dialogue. It's a form of dialogue that you could say is between two parts of your being. You could say between a higher self and who you think you are, if you don't think you're that higher self yet. Or it can be with a being external to yourself, like if I talk to my guru all the time. The interesting question is that, or the thing I've noticed is that as you become more aware, you are less likely to use those conversations to ask for anything other than, I'd love to know how it all works, or what am I supposed to do now, or something like that. But to say, would you please do it this way, like save this child. I mean, I really don't know, because I don't even know why that child is suffering. How presumptuous of me to think that I have the right to decide. It's like saying, you know, the universe is kind of screwed up, but I'll put it right with my mind. And so all I really do in my dialogues is really listening and trying to tune. And what I've often recommended to people is that, just like my relation with my guru, people adopt an imaginary playmate, which is somebody you hang out with and talk to all the time. And it's somebody who's wise, who's caring, who's compassionate, who's loving, etc. And for me, the fun is that after a long time, you realize that your imaginary playmate is real, and you're imaginary. It's a great moment of fun. Ladies and gentlemen, it's 9:30, and I promised to stop at that time. It's 3 hours. Sorry I couldn't take all your questions. Thank you very much. Nice evening.